This is the lecture for week 7, Atmosphere as a Commons and Common Property Trusts. Now, these are obviously very big topics. We're going to focus mostly on the works of Peter Barnes, a businessman and student and activist of the commons and how to solve the problems of global warming. The themes for today are going to be about how the atmosphere functions as a commons and what might be done to deal with that. Peter Barnes' solution is what he called in his 2001 book, The Sky Trust, and more recently has been known as Cap and Dividend, a policy proposal for helping to encourage the reductions in carbon emissions. And then we're going to talk about Peter Barnes' later book, 2006, Capitalism 3.0, A Guide to Reclaiming the Commons. And in many ways, this book is an outgrowth of the thinking that started with him in Who Owns the Sky. In that book, Barnes talks about commons trusts as a way to deal with many problems of the market, how if we establish new systems of common property and the right institutions, especially trusts, we can help deal with things like market externalities and the interests of future generations, social equity, and good governance more effectively than we have so far. So even though Barnes writes in a terribly accessible and lucid way, he's dealing with some very deep and complicated themes that have a lot of academic depth to them. But let's start with Who Owns the Sky? Barnes approached this issue because he considered a kind of koan that raises all sorts of philosophical, economic, political, and moral questions that we need to grapple with today, because we're starting to realize that the sky is a finite resource. For most of human history, we regarded it as essentially infinite and indestructible. And only in recent decades have we started to realize that the sky is, in fact, a limited resource. And we need to deal with that, especially since in the past 200 years, we've developed a market culture that sees limitless growth as the ideal. Our culture and economy have not incorporated ways to regard certain things as inalienable and how to impose certain limits on market activity, because maximum growth, more, better, faster, is seen as the ethic of our time that has to be met. So Peter's, I say Peter because he's a friend of mine, a friend and colleague, he raised a number of these issues in his 2001 book, and he starts by noting that common property rights, in fact, have a long history. We discussed this in an earlier week, how the Romans, for example, had a category for common property. They had something called res communes, for commons things, and these were things that were accessible to everyone that could not be owned exclusively by the government or individuals. And it had other categories like res publica, which were public things that were owned and set aside for public use by the government, like buildings and highways and navigable waterways. And there was even a legal category of res nullius, which were unowned things, things that had no property rights attached to them until they're taken into possession. And then they become res privitae, which is privately owned property. So, for example, wildlife might be such an example. Barnes also mentions how in English law there were categories respecting the commons. So, for example, the Magna Carta in 1215 established fisheries as a res commune, a commons available to everyone. Before that, the king could grant exclusive fishing rights to people. So they were not common property. So Barnes cites these things as a way to show that the commons and collective property is not a totally novel concept. It just seems that way in our market culture. Yet at the same time, Barnes is skeptical about government as the trustee of of our collective resources. We'll get to that in a little bit, but as we well know, government often is corrupted by private interest, and it allows the abuse or sale at below market value of the public's resources. Now, the challenge at hand for Barnes is how to protect the atmospheric commons. And Barnes develops an ingenious way to do this with collective property rights and market forces. And he also sees it as a way to help solve some social issues, namely helping deal with income inequality. Because the Sky Trust essentially works like this. You set up a system by which if you're going to pollute carbon into the air, you need a permit. And to get that permit, you have to buy it at an auction. And so there'll be essentially a market for pollution rights for carbon. And of course, industry will be among the major users of these permits, and that means they'll have to pay money to pollute where previously they had been using the sky as a free waste dump. Now, the point of doing this is to establish a disincentive to companies to pollute. If they have to pay $100 per pollution share or whatever the market price is, it's going to raise their costs, and they're going to find way, they'll therefore have incentives to find ways to reduce their pollution, either by developing better technologies or running their systems more efficiently. But of course, having permits for pollution will raise the price of anything that needs carbon fuel, coal, gasoline, heating oil, whatever. Those prices will go up, and this could hurt the economy, many people say. And one way to mitigate that, as Barnes sees it, is to establish a sky trust. Now, a sky trust would be a non-governmental trust, which would be the formal steward or custodian of the funds raised by all those auctions for pollution rights. And that great pool of money, which would go into the tens of billions of dollars, would kick off dividends because it would be invested in the stock market and other investment vehicles. And those dividends, instead of going to the government or to the companies who are polluting, would go to every household in America based on a one-person, one-share rule. And the idea for this would be that people would be people who, we all own the sky and therefore are entitled to whatever scarcity value it can generate. And as Barnes sees it, a sky trust would be a scarcity rent recycling machine. As consumers, citizens, and others pay more for burning fossil fuels, they would, of course, pay higher prices. But as owners in the sky, so to speak, as owners of shares in the Sky Trust, they would get yearly dividends. And so people who burned more carbon would lose money, and those who burned less carbon would come out ahead. So the general scheme is to use market forces to get incentives correctly aligned. And one real virtue of this is that it would give everyone some non-labor income. Normally, of course, the rich are the ones who have non-labor income. They have investments and can often live off them alone. By giving the ordinary person income that doesn't come from his own labor, he would have greater stability, economic stability in his life, and it would help deal with the inequality of incomes in our society. Peter Barnes explains much more of this scheme at the Cap and Dividend website, www.capanddividend.org. So you can learn more about it there. What's interesting about the scheme also is that the shares that individuals have in the Sky Trust are not tradable. You can't just sell them. Essentially, they're rights that come to you by dint of your citizenship. And so they're not. The goal is not to maximize the market value from your share in the Sky Trust, but to assert your birthright in having a moral stake in the integrity of the sky. it's a sign also of our national collective interest together in protecting the sky. Now, there's some pointed questions that can be raised about the Sky Trust. Why should the sky be turned into property at all, some people say? Barnes's response is that if we don't turn it into property and use a vehicle such as this, we're going to ruin the sky. So while it might at one level seem repugnant to assign property rights in the sky, in other ways it's a terrific and effective way to help reduce pollution into it. Another complaint that might be raised is, why do we need a market scheme like this with government setting it up? I know that in Latin America, for example, many people have balked at Barnes's scheme because they're quite correctly skeptical of government in Latin America, because governments there often are very corrupt, and they don't see government as an honest dealer, either in setting up a trust of this sort, let alone having it be administered and the money finding its way properly to people. So that's another criticism raised. And other people will say, is this really a commons? There's no social dimension as there are in most commons. It seems to be kind of a bureaucratized hybrid that has perhaps some commons elements, but not commons in the way that Eleanor Ostrom or others might understand it. Well, we can leave this topic for now. Let's just conclude by saying that after some major setbacks in the idea of the Sky Trust in the U.S. Congress in 2008, now in 2009, the U.S. Senate is actually considering a bill that would establish a cap-and-dividend system for reducing carbon emissions. It's the so-called Cantwell-Collins bill. And so there's still a chance that this scheme might be instituted and set a new precedent in how to protect a common resource through an innovative market commons hybrid. But let's move on to Peter Barnes's second book, well, the second book of a commons-related book, Capitalism 3.0, A Guide to Reclaiming the Commons. In this book, Barnes likens capitalism to a, quote, economic operating system, sort of like a computer operating system. And he essentially argues we need to do an upgrade, that the embedded code of the system is obsolete and is not serving our needs in contemporary times. What made a lot of sense in the 18th or 19th centuries is now seen as far more problematic, especially for nature. He points out that in the 18th and 19th century, what we really needed was to amass capital and put it to productive uses to help develop wealth and help make life easier. And at the time, nature was seen as limitless and indestructible, and therefore whatever harms occurred to nature were seen as essentially negligible or tolerable. But we're now seeing that that's just not true, and that the operating system that we now live under, which was devised 200 or 300 years ago, is dysfunctional because it doesn't recognize what Barnes calls the capitalism production of ilth. The opposite of wealth, he says, is ilth, which is a term coined by John Ruskin, the literary figure, several centuries ago. Now, a modern economist would call ilth a negative externality. And this is the pollution, the depletion of the ecosystem and habitat, the disruptions of communities, the social inequalities, the over-marketization of all aspects of life, essentially the negative externalities that our economic system routinely produces. And the problem is our economic discourse doesn't properly recognize the amount of ilth that we're creating and how we need to reduce it somehow. For example, the United Nations Environment Program recently calculated that the value of the negative externalities produced, the negative value of negative externalities produced by 3,000 of the world's largest corporations amounted to $2.2 trillion in 2008. Now, that's essentially $2.2 trillion displaced onto other people or on the natural ecosystems. But, of course, to the corporations, it was a gift for free. And this is a serious imbalance that somehow we need to deal with. People might ask, why has ILF been ignored historically? And I guess the short answer is our mental maps and our metrics are just too limited to recognize it. Some people just don't want to recognize it because there's money to be made from ignoring the ILF that's created. And so our economic discourse sees greater value coming from market activity and doesn't see the diffused, often invisible harms that come through pollution, overdevelopment, and so forth. Another thing that's happened in the past 200 years is that our production capacity has become so great that essentially basic needs can now be met. This was not always true. Yet the system keeps inventing new needs that because the money is to be made from churning the production machine more and more and more. The problem isn't that we can't produce enough. The problem is that there's inadequate demand, quote, from people who don't have money. So people are not having basic needs met, and there's a lot of inequality, even though we have the productive capacity to serve everybody's basic needs. Now, Barnes calls this the move from shortage to surplus capitalism. As he puts it, there's no limit to what corporations can produce. Their problem is finding buyers. The real shortages that we have today are of time, companionship, and community, all of the things that are being colonized or marginalized by market activity. As Barnes sees it, there are three major pathologies of what he calls capitalism 2.0. This is the our current stage of surplus capitalism. Capitalism 1.0 was earlier capitalism when it was dealing with shortage capitalism. So capitalism 2.0's pathologies are, one, its tremendously destructive attitudes towards nature. The United Nations has found that 60% of the world's ecosystems that are necessary to support life on Earth are being used unsustainably. One could go through the long catalog, depressing catalog of harms that are being done to the Earth, but that is certainly one of the major issues of the past century. Second, inequality. Currently, the top 5% of people in the United States own more than the bottom 95%. And the wealthy have structural advantages in maximizing their wealth, which over time simply makes inequality worse and worse and worse. And part of this is due to globalization, whose point is basically to accelerate or enhance the wealth of the wealthy, and it has very little help in getting in the impoverished getting out of poverty. The third pathology of capitalism 2.0 is there's really no net increase in happiness. Just because gross domestic product is rising doesn't mean that happiness is rising, even though, of course, economists equate the satisfaction of consumer demand with happiness. It's sort of they, of course, don't probe that concept very deeply because it would fall apart. But that's the operating principle, that greater material consumption equals greater happiness. And of course, we know this isn't true, but capitalism persists in developing what Barnes calls, citing Dr. Seuss, new theeds, T-H-N-E-E-D-S, which is a silly term for artificially developed wants. Capitalism needs these artificial wants, these needs, in order to bolster the demand for its immense, unquenchable productive capacity. And so we have this vast production machine destroying the earth, producing greater inequality and not even really making us happier. So what to do? The first line of defense that many people think of is government. But as Barnes points out, government has inherent limits in being able to control capitalism. We're all by now familiar with the dynamic of regulatory capture, in which businesses that have superior resources and technical and legal expertise and campaign finance funds to give to Congress and lobbyists are essentially able to overwhelm or at least neutralize whatever government might want to do to protect nature and preserve greater equality among us. And part of the problem is that the public is unorganized and its interests are diffuse, while corporations have very focused short-term interests and the money to do something about it. The public has maybe only minor stakes in a given public policy outcome, but business will have a very focused and large stake. Government also, there's a problem in that government-administered stewardship of our resources, our collective resources, often doesn't work very well because government will side with property owners and capital and give away resources, public resources, rather than stoutly defending them. And again, one could cite a very long list. I'll just cite a few. The 1872 Mining Act is infamous for allowing mining interests to cart away tens of billions of dollars of the public's minerals over the past 140 years. A major scandal that persists to this day because Western senators continue to resist any reform of a law passed when Ulysses S. Grant was president. The U.S. Forest Service routinely sells the public timberland at below market rates. The government has done a terrible job in preventing fisheries from being over-harvested, such that many are now in danger of collapsing altogether. We have countless chemicals being spewed into the environment with the most minimal of controls, and lots of toxic waste sites that are still uncleaned up decades later. And then, of course, the carbon dioxide emissions that are now causing a major imminent crisis. One general conclusion we can draw from all this is that capitalism distorts the democratic process and the outcomes that people may wish. And this is the fact we're grappling with today. It's only gotten worse with the U.S. Supreme Court announcing that corporations should be legally considered people and therefore have all sorts of entitlements to give money to candidates as their free speech right. It's, of course, a massive legal fiction and power grab by the corporate sector sanctioned by the Supreme Court, but it's symptomatic of the problem. Robert Monks, the shareholder activist, has put it succinctly, the corporation is an externalizing machine. It's just what they do. By externalizing machine, what he means and what economists mean is they take whatever costs they can and displace them onto others, communities, the environment, individuals. They displace risks, safety or health risks, because the point of the corporation is to maximize private value, and they have a fiduciary duty to do that under the law. So that's what they do. And as a result of this, many of the attempted reform approaches really don't work too well. So, for example, corporate social responsibility can work sort of at the margins, but it really can't change the basic code or the imperatives of capitalism to maximize profit for shareholders. Barnes cites the example of the Pacific Lumber Company in California, which was a family-owned business that was the private owner of old-growth redwood trees, some of the oldest in the world. And when it logged, it left half the trees standing, and it allowed the natural canopies to persist, and this all helped keep the soil stable. And the company was also generous to its workers and rented them housing at below market rates, and all sorts of other really enlightened things. However, its behavior made the company pray for a takeover, because its practices diminished its profits, and therefore its stock price was lower than it should have been, or could have been. And because of this, a corporate raider, Charles Hurwitz, decided to buy the company in 1985 through his holding company called Maxim. And at first the directors refused, but then Hurwitz threatened to sue them, and he finally prevailed. And of course, immediately began to maximize profits and do away with many of the enlightened practices that Pacific Lumber had previously used. Now, the point of is simply that that's the inexorable way the system works under the current operating code. For the same reason, socially responsible investing is limited in what it can change. Major shareholders like pension funds and other institutional investors are required under the law as fiduciaries to maximize the return on investment. So there's only so much they can do to promote socially responsible management practices. And furthermore, the socially responsible investment movement can't really scale enough to be a transformative force. It can only work really around the edges. Another approach that has been suggested is often called free market environmentalism. Use the market to try to develop more socially and environmentally benign results. The major idea here is to use to establish markets for pollution in which the polluter will pay the people who are victimized by the pollution. And it sounds great in theory, but in practice it doesn't really work. The millions of victims of pollution are just too many and often even not identifiable to create a real viable market with a handful of large polluters. And it's too expensive for those victims to sue the polluters, especially when litigation is so expensive and technically complex. And individual negotiations with the polluters doesn't work either. As the economists might say, the transaction costs are simply too large to use market forces to abate pollution in that fashion. Barnes points out that there is a way to use market forces, however, but to have a commons-oriented outcome. And the way he describes it is, let's propertize nature, but don't privatize it. And there is a difference. His idea is to turn nature into common property rather than corporate property. And that means assigning new types of property rights to nature that are then assigned to all of us, as opposed to the corporations that pollute. Now, this is important because allowing the corporations to pollute without charge or simply to have property rights in their pollution is to give them a massive giveaway worth literally trillions of dollars, because certainly humankind ought to be able to claim a moral entitlement to the earth and not just a handful of self-selected companies that are destroying the earth and not even being good stewards. Barnes points out that the value of these natural assets that we hold, and then let's throw in the social assets, are far greater than private and government assets put together. But this fact is rarely seen because the private assets are generally expressed in terms of money. We have a dollar value for them, whereas the value of the natural assets and our social assets have no price tag associated with them. They're essentially invisible. And so we don't see our commonwealth. We don't see the many things that have value that don't have a price tag. So let's just take the idea of trust. Markets couldn't function without trust in them. It's a social asset that's worth something. And in fact, government helps develop a lot of this trust in markets through regulatory systems that help assure that products are safe and that the consumer is not getting ripped off. This is a value that's not seen at all. It's a commons value. Peter Barnes used to be an entrepreneur, and he once took his company public, meaning it was a privately owned company, and he sold shares into it, shares in his company to the general public. And immediately upon doing that, the value of the company, the cash value of it, increased by 30%. And Barnes realized that there's something called a liquidity premium. By taking your company public and suddenly having it liquid, meaning it can be bought and sold, its value increases. Well, this is due to the entire regulatory financial apparatus and infrastructure that the Securities and Exchange Commission and the body of laws and other factors have created to allow there to be a functioning, trustworthy market in companies. Well, that 30% essentially represents the public value, publicly generated value, which is all privatized. So when you take a company public, you're essentially privatizing the wealth or the value that was created by government and laws and other social creations. You're taking that private. So that gives some measure of the magnitude of publicly created value that is privatized. And of course, we know that nature has great value, but again, it's not usually expressed in dollar terms. In 2002, however, economist Robert Costanza calculated the value of what's often called nature's services, because ecosystems do all sorts of things that have economic value. Bees pollinate crops, and wetlands help purify water, all sorts of things like that. And in an admittedly crude estimate, Costanza calculated that ecosystem services amount to about $2 trillion. Of course, there's no market for them per se, but he was trying to express the magnitude of them, especially relative to the conventional market economy. Now, to get back to the story drawn by Peter Barnes, Barnes is urging that we create property rights for common assets, what he calls common property rights. And the goal should be to use those property rights and market forces to limit what the market can appropriate and use, while at the same time expanding access and use to those resources by commoners. And the goal is also to help preserve the resource for posterity, for future generations. And Barnes wants to do it through, his solution is a system of trust, and I'll get to that in a minute, but giving people one share in a trust, one share per person in trusts that are assigned the duty of protecting collective resources. So it's a new legal system of trusts which use property rights for collective goods to protect them equitably for everyone into the future, so future generations can also enjoy them. One of the great unresolved paradoxes of property law history was John Locke's assertion of the labor theory of value. Locke said that God gave the earth to mankind in common, and that when people exploit nature or take the land, there must be, quote, good enough, there must be enough and as good left in common for others. Now, that last clause is usually ignored, and simply people take things saying, I invested my labor and therefore I'm entitled to it. Well, Barnes is trying to address how this often forgotten clause in Locke can be honored, how we can make sure that there is enough and as good left in common for others. And his solution is to start new institutions that can preserve the commons by putting a price tag on finite natural resources such as the sky when used as a free waste dump. Barnes calls for the creation of a common sector. And by that he means new sorts of institutions that actively and effectively protect the commons. In fact, Barnes envisions the rise of an entire sector to counterbalance both the market and government in protecting the interests of commoners. And the chief institutional vehicle he sees for this is the trust. For Barnes, the trust is to the commons as the corporation is to the market. And one reason nature is so vulnerable and unprotected is because it has inadequate property rights and institutional defenders. Barnes says that capital is allowed to trump all other concerns and interests, the divine right of capital, as Marjorie Kelly puts it in her book of that title. So Barnes thinks that nature and other common assets should be assigned property rights so that they can be adequately protected and preserved for future generations. And he sees the trust as being an effective legal vehicle for doing this for several reasons. One, a trust has undivided loyalty to the beneficiaries, which is very different from government, which has a zillion different interests and has trouble protecting them. A trust is charged with preserving the capital or the asset. That's its paramount priority. So it's single-minded in its focus. And that's important when we're dealing with nature. A trust has to operate transparently and be accountable to beneficiaries, the commoners. And that's important. And a trust is a familiar legal vehicle. It's not some newfangled invention that hasn't been tried. It's very familiar, and there are strict, legally enforceable rules that can be applied to a trust. And as a non-governmental legal structure, it's not subject to the same kinds of corruptions as government. Now, to be sure, there will be some bad players, and corruption is not impossible to conceive of. But Barnes believes, and it seems quite credible, to think that trusts could be a more defensible guardian of common resources. Now, the trust has quite a history, as has been pointed out. There are hundreds of land trusts in the United States. In the United Kingdom, there's the National Trust that administers literally hundreds of historic properties and vast expanses of land of great scenic beauty and historical importance. And there's all sorts of those just beautiful tracts of land that can be protected in perpetuity through the trust. If you want to expand the notion of the trust a little bit conceptually, you could say that conservation easements on private land are a type of trust. They're a way of the public interest being protected into the future. Or consider the general public license in software, which in a way is a vehicle for a community of free software developers protecting that code as a common resource now and into the future. Or the Wikimedia Foundation does the same thing for Wikipedia and other wiki resources. But getting back to the atmosphere, Barnes sees these trusts, or a sky trust, as being an institutional valve that can control the flow of pollutants into the ecosystem. Markets have no ability to limit their output of pollution on their own, and government is subject to all sorts of political whims and corruptions and short-term pressures, and really doesn't adequately take account of the needs of future generations. So why not institute a trust, says Barnes. Develop a trust as the keeper of the valve for carbon output. And such a trust could rely on expert scientific evidence and remain relatively more insulated from political pressures than Congress or regulatory agencies or international bodies. And appointees to the trust could act like the Federal Reserve does with respect to the money supply It could turn the spigot on or off depending upon the demonstrable needs and be somewhat insulated from political pressure. Whereas Barnes writes, unpriced externalities would become property rights under accountable management. If a corporation wanted to pollute, it couldn't just do so. It would have to buy rights from the Commons Trust. The price of pollution would go up. Corporate ilth would go down. Ecosystems would be protected for future generations. More income would flow to ordinary citizens. Non-human species would flourish. Human inequality would diminish. And government wouldn't be enlarged. Our economic engine would do these things on its own. The problem is that the market uses nature without debiting a liability on its books. The liability is simply displaced onto ecosystems. So common property rights in the trust would put back on the accounting books all sorts of values that are currently pushed off the books and ignored. The shared entitlements to nature, the intergenerational obligations, and the interests of non-humans, animals and wildlife and organisms that perhaps not only deserve to live, but are functionally important to ecosystems. Unfortunately, the two current economic concepts that we have for trying to rein in economic liabilities just don't work. One is ecosystem services, where we assign an abstract dollar sum to the service that nature performs. Well, the problem with that is there's no owner of the resource or balance sheet for that number to really be put to meaningful use. And then we have the idea of public goods as a class of resources that government sometimes steps in to help provide. But expenditures on public goods are not usually seen as adding value to any asset because they're not really owned by anyone. And in any case, the government is chronically squeezed for cash, especially by private industry that wants its own subsidies. So public goods is not a very powerful concept for acting as a proxy for nature. So for Barnes, again, it comes back to the trust as a way to administer common property more effectively and recognize just a new category of economic, ecological, and social value. And here's how it would work. The government would assign the common property rights to the trust. The future generations would be represented by the trust as a legal duty. The trustees would also have a legal duty to protect the shared asset, in this case the atmosphere, and not to maximize revenue. And the revenue that was generated could be given to the commoners or allocated to public goods, such as restoring the ecology. But the point would be that the negative externalities that were previously off the book would now show up in the books of the trust and could be properly taken account of. And the way that this is so elegantly beautiful is a commons trust would yield less pollution and more income for commoners while protecting the interests of future generations. And would also shift income from the rich to the poor, because the rich would pay more for their pollution permits than the poor, who tend to use less per capita of carbon in their lives. So they would come out ahead through the recycling of those dividends from the trust. Barnes makes a very bold claim that sharing commons rent through per capita dividends isn't just the best way to bring our economy into harmony with nature. It's also the best way to reduce poverty. And that's because there's no other pool of money of comparable size to which poor people have a legitimate claim. The poor don't have any property rights or capital to lift themselves out of property. This would be one small tool for that. It would also be a nice alternative to the taxing and spending that government tends to do, which is fraught with all sorts of problems as well, even though it's, of course, quite necessary and it needs to be bolstered. So the common sector is I find a very compelling vision, in that the cap and dividend, the Sky Trust would be one major prototype, but Barnes suggests a variety of other types of trusts that could fill out this sector. He calls one the Children's Opportunity Trust, which is something similar to what they have in Great Britain, where every newborn child is given a small sum of money, a few hundred dollars, put into a trust fund, which over the next 18 years accrues all sorts of interest and grows in size, so that when a child comes of age, they have a small trust fund that they can use to develop themselves, get their footing as an adult, be it as an entrepreneur, getting an education, buying a house, just getting started in life, something that many wealthy children have as a matter of course. Other trusts would be to, one idea is to share health risks through a national insurance pool. This is often known as single payer, and that essentially is a trust for everyone. Of course, because it would displace the private insurance system that is predatory and parasitic, it's resisted, but that's another idea that would fill out the common sector. There are ideas like watershed trusts and air trusts. A number of states in New England have created the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative to collectively reduce their greenhouse gas emissions and treat the air shed above them as a collective trust. There's been ideas like creating a Buffalo Commons in the Midwest that would preserve tracts of land of prairie for buffaloes and other indigenous species to bring them back. Clearly, the idea is at a very early stage, and there's, of course, many other ideas for how the institutions and legal regimes of a common sector might be built. But it's a fantastic idea, politically, economically, and culturally, and it certainly deserves to be explored and developed. As far as Barnes's specific Sky Trust cap and dividend proposal, there are some criticisms that are understandable. Some people think it relies too much on the market. Some people think it gives government too much of a role that might not work so well. If could government, for example, establish these trusts or carbon markets properly in the first place? An open question. Is this really a commons? Well, yes, it is in terms of protecting a resource that collectively belongs to us all, but it isn't a commons in the classical sense of being a social, socially driven, socially oriented management regime with mass participation. In a way, it's a bureaucratically managed system, similar to the Alaska Permanent Fund, which manages the oil revenues from state lands in Alaska in the same fashion, where all the households of Alaska get about $1,000 a year from the oil revenues cycled through an oil trust known as the Alaska Permanent Fund. So people can quibble whether this is actually a commons. I happen to think it serves many commons functions. We could call it a commons-based solution. Because the bottom line is that it's a practical, thoughtful, elegant policy tool for protecting important common assets. And for that reason alone, deserves to be explored and implemented. And hopefully the U.S. Senate will actually go the distance on that. Well, this is my brief discussion of Peter Barnes's ideas about the atmosphere and commons trusts. Again, those books are Capitalism 3.0 and Who Owns the Sky. In our next lecture, week 8, we'll be talking about the second enclosure movement. And by this, we're talking about the rise of copyright and trademark law and patent law as new ways to enclose knowledge and culture that belongs to all of us. So we'll resume with week 8.